Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
On the last episode of Guilt.
Leaving Boom's flat now, we're heading back down and can't help but feel that if the cadets did see the tent and everything in the car in this place they said they did, and that's also the same place Tamahedi said that he saw the box, it's a hell of a coincidence.
And the white Subaru came towards me, and the reason I noticed is the bull bar on the front. And I thought, what a good idea, because they're a four-wheel drive wagon, and I thought, well, that'd be good for hunting. And as they come past, there was a stunning-looking girl in the passenger seat, and there was a white guy driving. But the strange thing was, there was a Maori boy sitting in the middle of the back seat and just looked out of place.
And he would just search for years, walking all the tracks, going off the tracks. It could just consume them.
I was the last one that probably ever saw them alive, and I've never told anybody.
They've obviously been digging, and I've just pulled a bone out. There's a piece of bone right here.
From Brevity Studios, I'm Ryan Wolfe, and this is Guilt. In the last two episodes, we've heard from two new witnesses who both believe they saw Heidi in her barn alive in their white Subaru station wagon with a Māori man. Both of these sightings are huge new developments in this case and can help provide the previously missing link between Thames and Parakawai. But what happened next? During this investigation, my focus has progressively shifted from Thames on the west coast to Whangamātā and Parakawai on the east coast. And almost as if on cue, another new witness came forward who may hold a tantalizing clue. But before we hear from him, I'd like to share a recent conversation I had with a relative of an important witness in this case. Her name is Kay Manning, and she's the daughter of Foursquare owner Graham Manning, who was a key witness in the police's case. It was Graham that reported that he had spoken to Heidi in her barn. He told police that they had made clear their intentions of hiking the Tararu track. Kay told me that her sister, Michelle, was working early shifts at the Foursquare during this time in 1989, and recalled seeing David Tamahedi, and also a group of three men who she thought at the time were acting like they just killed someone.
Hello?
Hi, is this Michelle?
Speaking.
Hey, this is Ryan Wolfe. How are you?
Good, thank you.
So Kay might have mentioned just briefly, she said that you guys might have thought that he was just trying to get a bit of, attention for...
Well, look, there could have been that in too, and not only that, but he was very friendly with the cops that were running the show. And, of course, they had an account running at the shop and everything for their stuff. And when I heard on your podcast how they kind of appeared maybe to groom Cassidy a little bit, it may have been partially like that with my father as well.
Okay.
Look, I'm not saying it was,
yeah.
But, you know, it just didn't fit right with me and my sister at the time, you know?
Like Michelle said, she can't say that this is definitely the case. But is it possible that Graham may have taken some liberties with his statement about seeing Heidi in her barn? They certainly think it's possible. The fact that he was very friendly with police running the case needs to be noted. Michelle says they had a running account at the store during their time investigating in Thames. I recall when I first read Graham's initial statement, he simply says he believes he spoke to Heidi in her barn in early April. He doesn't specify a date. However, at some point, I noticed a date appears, with no real explanation, and his sighting is given the date of April 6th. But that's not why I'm speaking to Michelle. I'm interested in what she saw in the early hours on a couple mornings in April of 1989. So were you working in the grocery store at the time?
Yep. I was doing I always did the early morning shift. So I would go down to the shop about 5 o'clock in the morning. And I would have the doors open soon after that. And then I would have about 5:30, another lady who worked with me, she would start. So for a time, I was there on my own.
Yep.
Until she arrived. And so it was dark, still dark, and I would put the signboards out on the side of the footpath, you know?
Yep.
And on this particular day, I put the signboard out in the dark. I looked up towards the north of the main street, and here was this person walking down the street in the middle of the footpath. And I thought, oh, yeah. Anyway, I went back into the shop, and then he came in the shop. Well, when he came in the shop, you see, we always, people who were regulars and who smoked, we always knew the cigarettes that they were coming in for, you know?
Yeah.
So as soon as we see them walk in the door, we reach for the cigarette that they, of their brand, and it would be already sitting for them waiting at the counter. And when this guy, he came into the shop, when this guy walked in, I thought, oh yeah, that's so-and-so Watney. I'll reach for his cigarettes. Because this Watney guy, he would come in sometimes, but not every single day. And sometimes you wouldn't see him for maybe 2 or 3 weeks or whatever the case may be. I reached for the cigarettes, and the person told me a different brand. I thought, oh, that's funny. You must have changed your cigarette brand. So anyway, I gave him the cigarettes, and he left. Now, that's why I remember him. And I can still see him to this day, as clear as a bell, coming down the main street.
Yep.
That's why I remember him, because it wasn't the cigarettes that I was expecting. And the person that he resembled actually would have been slightly smaller than him, but very much the same features, moustache, Maori guy, hair, much similar style. You know, that's why I assumed it was the guy Watney, when in fact it was Tamihere. Now, I didn't say anything at the time. I thought, oh, yeah. Now, this could have happened 2 days in a row, twice. No more than twice he would have come into the shop at that time in the morning.
Yeah.
And because, you see, he would have come down the main street, possibly looking for cigarettes, but there would have been no other shops open at that time of the morning.
Okay.
Which is why he ended up at our shop. Yeah. But I never, as time progressed, and I don't even know if they were reported missing. I can't remember by at that stage. But I never recognised them, putting two and two together, until I seen on TV the footage of him being charged at the Thames Court. And that's when I recognised, oh, that was that guy. Yeah. That's why the cigarettes didn't match up.
Okay.
And, yeah, and I thought, that's that guy. Anyway, so that was the end of that little scenario.
Yeah.
Now, right at the same time, I was leasing some land down at Tararoo, right behind the District Homes, which is now the Bupa care home.
Yeah.
Now, in behind there was all paddocks, and I was leasing those for my horses. And that, of course, is right at the end of Victoria Street.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in those days, the road verge, which was a very wide verge down that street, wasn't mowed by the council. And there was a bit of poo-ha growing in the long grass. And I was down at the paddock one day. I see this guy appear from nowhere, and he had a sack in his hand, and he was picking the poo-ha. And then he just disappeared. And then, and as time goes by, you think, oh, shit, that's right. I've seen that guy, and that's now I know who that was. And then there was, around about the same time, but obviously at that time, I didn't realise it, but the lady that was working with me early in the morning in the shop, we were in the shop, it was still dark outside. A car comes from the northern end, and it pulls over to the opposite side of the road and parks parallel to the shop. So he didn't just park and walk across the road to the shop, right?
Yeah.
He parks facing the other way, right outside the shop, which sometimes people did that at that time of the morning, you know, nobody was around. These three guys got out of it and came into the shop. Now, when they came in, they were really hyped and pumped up, and they were quite spooky. And one of them I looked at, and he had a leather jacket on. And I quite liked the leather jacket, but it just didn't look right on him. It was distressed leather, you know, not like a black vinyl or anything like that. It was a distressed leather jacket.
Yeah.
And they were so jumpy, but they were getting a bit of food. So we served them and they left. And when they left, I just turned around to the lady that was working with me. I said, I thought, Jesus Christ, I thought, they look like they've just murdered somebody. You know, that was just the feeling that I had and how I...
Yeah.
Okay, so...
What car?
I mean, now, the car, I couldn't say exactly what kind of car it was. All I know, what I can say, is it was not a dark-coloured car. And I think it might have been a station wagon. However, I can't say. It was definitely not a black one. It wasn't a dark green and it wasn't a dark blue.
Okay, so
it was a light coloured car. That's all I can say without imagining. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it stood out because of the energy that they were throwing off. You know, that they were just so hyped up.
Like a scary energy almost.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I said, Jesus. You know, they would have been looking over their shoulder and things like that. And that's what I said to my friend. I said, look, they just look like they murdered somebody. And that's just how it came out of my mouth at the time.
We don't have a date or any identification of this group of men. And well, it could be anyone. But I wanted to include it here as just a reminder that there were all kinds of people roaming these areas in the dark of the night. That date, April 6th, that was eventually locked in as the day Michelle's father, Graham Manning, says he spoke to Heidi in her barn. It could be key. We know that they were in Thames on April 7th, Their letter home was postmarked with the date and location. So that's a fact. This is also corroborated by Murray Jenkins' sighting. But where were they on the 6th? Looking at the police map of their known route through the North Island of New Zealand, which is corroborated with sightings and receipts, their path is logical. Taihape, Taupo, Rotorua, Tauranga, Waihi. But here, it takes a path that I would say isn't logical. According to police, they then drove from Waihi on April 5th, the east coast, across to Thames, on the west coast of the Coromandel Peninsula. And as any local or traveller would likely agree, it would make more sense to continue on to Whangamata and then follow the State Highway 25 Kopahikawe Highway to Thames. This route is more scenic and it means you won't have to backtrack. I spoke to a resident who recalls seeing Heidi in her barn in the Waihi New World supermarket in early April 1989.
I remember it was a sunny summer's day. That's all I really remember. I went into Waihi to go to the supermarket and these two gorgeous people speaking some foreign language was walking around talking, and I was absolutely mesmerised by them because at that time, like I said, there wasn't a lot of foreign tourists. And these ones seemed quite exotic because they were quite beautiful. Mm. Yeah, they just really stood out. And I was going to go and say to them, I didn't even know if they spoke English, if you need somewhere to stay, you're welcome to come back to our place and camp the night in your tent or your car, or we've got a spare bedroom. But I never did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I never did. And then, of course, I don't know how long after that, then they went missing. And then, police on the news and all radio and everything was asking for information, but what they were saying was, we don't want to hear from anybody who says they're in Waihi or Whangamata. Lots of people are ringing in saying they've seen them, but they weren't there, so stop ringing.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I clearly remember that, and I just thought, oh, well, there's no point in me ringing then, is it, to say, yes, I saw them in the supermarket.
What was it about them that you remember? So when you saw the television or in the newspapers and stuff, were you 100% sure that that was them?
Absolutely. I can still see them clearly now. I even know which aisle they were walking down when I saw them.
Wow. How would, you know, what can you kind of remember about them, sort of specifically?
Oh, she was gorgeous. You know, they were really, they had this light about them. She was just absolutely stunning. Hmm. Very tanned, white hair, blue eyes. Yeah. And yeah, he was gorgeous looking as well. That's all I remember. Gorgeous looking and speaking some language that I didn't understand. They were in shorts, t-shirts. I think they might have had a little, just trying to recall, like, they didn't have backpacks or anything on. But they had some sort of shoulder bag or something like that. It was a summer's day.
Yeah.
Mm. It was warm. Yeah.
Interesting.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It seems police must have accepted that the couple were in Waihi, and an ATM transaction would confirm this. But those coming forward saying they saw them in nearby Whangamata were being told, no, you're wrong. They weren't there. Well, we now know with almost absolute certainty that they were, when they were seen driving up Parakawai Quarry Road by Barry Lindsay. Just a reminder that Parakawai and Wentworth Valley are found in the Whangamata area. But the question is, when did they first visit Whangamata? Did they travel from Waihee along the coast 25 minutes to this beautiful beach town on April 5th or 6th? During my investigation, I came across a report of a couple matching the description of Heidi and her barn stopping at Purcell Panel Works in Waihee at this time, asking directions to Whangamata. I spoke to Jim Campbell, who formerly worked at this location and eventually had a successful career with the New Zealand Police. He recalled seeing who he believes was the couple in April of 1989.
Yeah, I just remember working in the workshop, and in my mind, I looked out down towards Tauranga Road, and I'm pretty sure Jim was down there speaking to this young couple, and in my mind, they had a vehicle. And they had a radiator problem from memory.
Okay.
And I just tend to remember looking out there and thinking, you know, young couple, she was an attractive woman, girl, and they looked to be the type that were probably, yeah, just knocking around the country, really. I definitely didn't speak to them. I saw them, I noticed them, and then further on down the track, when it all came to light as to what had occurred or was suspected to have occurred, then, yeah, I remembered. And, yeah, someone from the police came and spoke to me, then basically just took a, from my memory, a notebook entry for a job sheet, I would say. I suppose they just both looked young, healthy, lean backpacker types.
Yep.
She's blonde hair.
I've spoken to a few of the staff that worked at this location at the time, but I've yet to find the person who actually spoke to them that day. It seems that the couple did stop at the shop. Did they ask directions to Whangamata? Maybe. As usual, the fog of time makes accuracy of recollection difficult. But it would certainly make sense that they had. The location of the shop is also on a town exit, in a direction people commonly mistake as being towards Whangamata. I myself have made this mistake a number of times. The police's lack of interest and the passage of time has meant sightings of the couple in Whangamata have, for me at least, been difficult to confirm. But I've been told of them purchasing sausages at the local butchers and visiting the beach. To me, confirming their movements through this area is important, as it presents the opportunity to meet people. Perhaps those responsible for their murders. Forget about Tararu Creek and Crosby's Clearing. Because whether the police want to accept it or not, I can assure you that Heidi and her barn came to Whangamata alive in April of 1989. And tragically, they never left. And in the remaining episodes of this podcast, I'm going to prove it.
If you could just say your name and so you grew up in this area, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, so tell me about that, like how about your connection to this place. And
My name is Rodney Taupaki. I was raised there at Furuta by my tūpuna, my grandparents, until I left home when I was 16 and went to Auckland and then stayed in Auckland for a couple of years. Then I came back, got married, had a couple of kids, the only reason I got married. And then I went to Aussie, I was about 30, I think it was, about 84, 85. Stayed in West Australia for 5 years and came back. Stayed here for probably 10 or 12 years. Then went back to Queensland and I've been here ever since.
I'm meeting Rodney in a small wooden cabin in Waihee Campground. It seems fitting for this conversation. A stream runs past nearby, and we're surrounded by native New Zealand bush. Rodney reached out early in my investigation, telling me that he believed he saw Heidi and a man in Whangamatar, and that he never believed his story had ever been given any serious consideration by police. Rodney has been back and forward between Australia and New Zealand over the last 35 years, but he grew up in Whangamatar, and his family has traditional land in this area.
Well, we've got 6 acres, and then another rally's got acres, and it's all tied up with our iwi, our tribe, our Ngāti Hako tribe, all that land. Yeah.
So take me back to 1989. So you were over here at the time visiting?
No, I'd shifted back from Perth. It was probably, it was in winter, because I know I couldn't get out of bed till midday because it was too bloody cold. And my mother said, you know, she thought I was sick. And I said, no, it's too bloody cold to get up. So I didn't get up till midday. And I think I spent about a month there. I bought a tractor, a slasher from a guy, Smith, in Nauru, because all the paddocks were just overgrown. It was just a mess. Like, not just our 6 acres, but the other rallies, all their paddocks. So I cleaned up all their paddocks. And then my whangai brother, he sort of gave me a hand because he wasn't working. I wasn't working anyway, but because I'd just come back from Oz. Then I took him up to the pub, in Whangamatar pub, and shouted him lunch. And this Māori guy come in with this bloody beautiful blonde Sheila. I thought, oh, lucky bugger. And then they took one look at me and Stephen, who were the only guys in the pub. Then he did a U-bolt and went. And looking at her, it looked like she'd been crying. She had puffy eyes. But, you know, you didn't say nothing because he just looked at us, turned around and walked out again. And then they took off in that Subaru car. I didn't think nothing of it. And then when I was slashing the paddocks, one of my blades broke, so I had to go home with the tractor, put a new blade on, go back the next day, and that's when I saw that Subaru carpet. There was a batch at the top paddock and a lean-to, and it was parked in there, and I thought, oh, my rallies have stepped up, because normally they just had holding cars, and here's the Subaru parked there. And I didn't think nothing of it, just did my work, went back. And I don't know how long after that there was flyers going around Whangamatar and all the shops, have you recognised this guy? And it was Tamahere, or it looked like Tamahere with a beard and everything, and I thought, oh shit, that's the guy that I seen come in the pub with this blonde girl. I was going to go to the police, well I actually went to the police, but there was no one there, so I told my mother, and she said she'd go and see the police because she knew them pretty well, and I didn't. And then, like I said to her, oh, that Subaru car's up the top. And then she says, oh no, she doesn't want police going up around there because that's where our urupa is. And I think she didn't want anyone going and disturbing the cemetery, you know, because it's a private one, it's a family one. And then nothing happened after that. Didn't hear nothing. And then I moved back to Aussie. What year would have been? About 99, I think. Yeah, just after my stepfather died. He died in 99. And then moved back to Aussie. Then when I came back one year, my cousins in Pairua said that Tamahere was appealing or whatever it was, and that I knew that I'd seen him and her, and so they said to me, oh, go to the police and make a statement. So I went to the police in Auckland, made a statement, didn't hear nothing. And my cousins from Pairua, they managed a hotel in Auckland. And I stayed there when I flew back to New Zealand, you know, because I had free accommodation with them having a hotel. Then didn't hear nothing.
Mm. You know, so I guess obviously there's been a big passage of time between now and back then. Mm. And I guess the key here comes down to, you know, that identification. And so at that time, how long was it afterwards when you saw the flyers from when you saw David at the...
Oh,
the hotel.
I can't really say.
Like roughly?
It was probably maybe the end of 89, because in 1990 I went back to Perth with the Whangamatar Golden Ollies rugby team. I went back there for about 3 weeks, flew back. So it's either the end of 89 or early in 1990.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be sure.
Okay, so within a 12-month period, though.
Yeah.
Because I'm just trying to imagine how fresh in your mind,
yeah.
you know, when you saw that, that you thought back to the hotel. Mm. But obviously, when you saw them coming that day...
I just thought, oh, a lucky bugger. He's got this beautiful blonde Shirley, you know. And, yeah.
And what were they doing when they came in? What was his body language like? What were...
He was just like holding, they were holding hands when he came in the door, took one look at me and Steve, and then turned around and went out again, still holding her hand, you know. And I thought, oh, they must have had domestics because she had puffy eyes. So I didn't think nothing of it after that.
And then you're inside, and then outside you see the car leave.
Yeah.
And so describe that car.
Well, it was a Subaru, but I wouldn't be sure of the colour because I think I made a statement to the police that it was light brown or brown, that colour, but. And then I read those articles last night, and it said a white Subaru.
Mm.
So they probably didn't think, you know, talking rubbish.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, obviously it becomes quite crucial. So, I mean, but I know it's hard to put a number on something, but, you know, if you were going to say at that time, like, how confident you were that it was David that came in?
Well, I wouldn't be confident that it was him, but according to the flyers that went around, it looked like him.
Yeah.
Like it could have been any Māori guy with a beard, you know, so maybe it was him, maybe it wasn't him, I don't know.
Okay.
But I know it was her because she was really striking.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, I know, like a huge amount of time has passed.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, I'm pretty certain it was her, yeah. He opened the door's at the end of the hotel, he opens the door, comes in with her holding hands, took a look at us. I don't know why he came in for, because he took a look at us. Me and Steve were the only two in the hotel, and then just turned around and went out again.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of it's strange. It's like you don't want anyone to see you, but then why would you be going
in? Yeah, why would he come into the hotel at all?
Rodney is unsure about one thing, and that's a 100% confirmation that it was David Tamahere that he saw. He says it was a Māori man that looked like him. But with the moustache and the beard, it's possible it could have been someone else that looked similar. However, Rodney is certain about one thing, that it was Heidi he saw with this man. His description of what she looked like does fit, and he describes a Subaru, although he admits he may have got the colour wrong when he initially spoke to police. So if it was Heidi, then how do we explain what Rodney saw? It would seem to indicate that she may have been taken against her will by this man. And where is her barn? I'll add here that we are going to hear from another witness who will describe a very similar situation in the Whangamata area in an upcoming episode. But we can't forget that we're talking about significant periods of time. Memories fade or change, but what gives Rodney's credibility is that he's not coming forward now out of the blue. He did speak to others about his sighting at the time, and eventually even made a statement to police. But what makes Rodney's sighting more interesting? He saw what he believes was the same Subaru station wagon. Again, a few days later, when he was working on his family's nearby property. Which is notable, given the fact that David Tamahere's family are connected to the Matilda block, which is directly adjacent to the shack Rodney claims to have seen the Subaru the second time. I asked Rodney about this.
Yeah, so I mean, so then yeah, so then within it's only a few days later, you said you saw the same vehicle up at the
yeah.
Is there any way that David, would David know about this place or
yeah? If he took that car up there, then he'd know because on the other side of the hill is the Matilda block, and that's where their land is.
The Matilda block is a block of land near Whangamata that is connected to the Tamahere family. Rumours over the years have suggested that somehow Tamahere may have taken Heidi here. is it possible that there could be any substance to this? As I say thanks and goodbye to Rodney, he tells me that if I want to see the location he saw the Subaru parked, I can. 15 minutes later, we're pulling into a bush-lined driveway 10 minutes out of Whangamata. I check in with the homeowner at the bottom of the drive before slipping the chain off the gate, and we make our way up through the bush to the location. Despite being very close to a town, it feels remote. The forest completely obscures the sky as we drive up a loose gravel road. A horse roaming free on the land meanders in front of our ute as we wind up the hill. After a few minutes, we round a corner and the bush gives way to a stunning vista of untouched coastline and ocean waves crashing against the shore. Below us, an utapa, or Māori cemetery, can be seen. This is the spot Rodney says he was working when he saw the Subaru. We park the ute, and I walk a short distance over to a clearing where broken remains of an old shed are scattered across the grass. Concrete foundations indicate this must be the place Rodney saw the car that day.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, if he did see, potentially, Heidi and David, and if it was the same car and he saw it up here, well then, right now I'm standing in the spot of the old shed and the lean-to, and there's a bunch of wood and stuff piled here, and I'm surrounded by thick native bush, and the view here is actually spectacular. The ocean is probably 500 meters away or so, and you were just surrounded by thick bush, and it's certainly isolated here. If you brought someone here, then you're probably going to be left pretty unbothered, if that makes sense. Or is it a different person? A different person in a different car. Oh, actually, there's actually an old foundation here of something. Some old foundations here of what actually looks to be an old building. Certainly interesting. And now it's time to move on.
It's time to move on from this location. But as far as the case goes, I can assure you that the biggest revelations are yet to come. Like any case, possible witness sightings are fraught with risk, but more particularly after 34 years have passed. Can we trust what they are saying is accurate? Importantly, all the people we'll hear from in this case, at the very least, tried to tell police their stories. And in this regard, there is still a lot you're yet to hear. You'll more than likely have many questions that are yet unanswered. Remember that I only tell you what you need to hear, episode to episode. But in the final feature-length episode, all of your questions will be answered, when I put all the pieces of the puzzle back together. But when it comes to witness sightings, there's one thing that, love it or hate it, has meant that sightings of the couple have stood out. Their looks. And in particular, Heidi's. She stood out. Simple as that. She looked so different to what people from these rural New Zealand towns were used to seeing. People noticed her and her barn. So for me, it gives me so much more confidence that those that say they saw her at that time probably did. And we'd be foolhardy to ignore them. But of course, every sighting must be approached with a grain of caution and can never be considered definitive. But if David Tamahedi could be convicted of the double murders on the vague sighting of a couple in Crosby's Clearing, in which the woman was wearing a poncho completely covering her head and had features like lots of makeup that didn't resemble Heidi at all, then surely Barry, Murray and Rodney's sightings must carry a lot of weight. But how do their sightings all fit together? What if I told you these witnesses are just the entree? If this was a film, they'd be the opening credits. So what's the main act? What could possibly be yet to come? All questions that will be answered in what I promise is going to be an emotional, action-packed, edge-of-your-seat ride over the final 5 episodes that will change the history of this case forever.
We've been to Punakaiki, where you can see some cliff rocks formed as pancakes on top of each other. It was beautiful and unbelievable nature. It's changing vastly from snow-covered mountains to dry grass hills and even to rainforests. We decided to go and visit a guy that Urban met on a fishing tour in Australia. He invited us to stay the night at his house. Simon, the guy that Urban met in Cairns, was going to work, so we got a key of our own and a house of our own. Urban made some pancakes and I listened to your tape. It's incredible that he trusted us and gave us a key and let us spend the time here all by ourselves. When they invite you to stay overnight and you say no, they can't understand that and seem to believe you are rude. To them it seems obvious that you should say okay and you should feel at home. Heidi.
Guilt is a Brevity Studios production. Written, produced and narrated by me, Ryan Wolfe. All opinions expressed in this podcast are exactly that, opinions, and are not a statement of fact by the podcast itself. All persons named are presumed innocent unless proven otherwise in a court of law. Voice acting in this episode, Anna Waddell as Heidi. You'll find further photos and video on my Instagram, RyanWolfeNZ, and I highly recommend you join the discussion with thousands of other Guilt listeners on Facebook at the Guilt Podcast Discussion Group. Guilt is a 100% independent production. We've never received a single dollar in taxpayer funding. You can support us to continue to make great content, plus get ad-free listening, bonus episodes and early release by becoming a Brevity Plus subscriber on Apple or Acast Plus. You'll find the details in the show notes of every episode. This podcast was written and edited without the use of AI.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance.
UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.